put a capacitor in the ground. Depending on where you put the capacitor in the circuit, then the capacitor will do what it needs to do. Does that make sense?
That makes a lot of sense. Whether it goes to ground or it goes to some other place, is a whole lot of difference.
Yes. Now, just think of another thing as this. Let's say you have a output. Okay, give you another example. If you have an amplifier, say a tube amplifier, you would have something called a blocking capacitor between the plate and the tuning circuit so that the B plus doesn't go onto the antenna line or onto get shorted to ground through the tuning circuits. So you would have a blocking capacitor that acts as a safety capacitor. In a solid-state amplifier, if you look at your radios, there's no voltage. There's no DC voltage on the output of your antenna connector. There's only RF. So in a lot of cases, you have a coupling capacitor. Another place where you have a capacitor, if you look at your Diamonds, your X50s, your 500s, they have a capacitor. Also, all CB antennas have to have capacitors so that that block DC and also 60 cycles. So if you're installing an antenna and that antenna hits a power line, you're not going to get killed. Does that also make sense?
Yes, very much so. The analogy to a diaphragm and a water pipe makes a tremendous amount of sense, as does, depending on the usage for the capacitor, it acts in different ways. Do all blocking capacitors or do all reasons to use capacitors for blocking go to ground?
No. When you go to ground, you're pulling something. When you go to ground, you're taking the high frequencies and pulling them to ground, usually in a block. It's in series. Think of it as that it's in line with something. So on one side, you would have the DC voltage. On the other side, you would have the RF voltage. If you come off of an amplifier, you have DC, and you have the RF component that will be sitting on the DC voltage, swinging up and down on the bias voltage. On the other end, all you're going to have is just the radio frequency without the DC component. So you have a blocking capacitor. Sometimes they're called safety capacitors because they make sure that the DC or the low frequency AC can't get through. Just like on an antenna, the capacitor will be at the bottom of the coil. Some capacitors, they're not there for high voltages.
The last question is, how do blocking capacitors block?
I think we went over that a million times. They block because DC doesn't change. Only something changing gets across the capacitor. If something is not changing, if you have a steady state condition, the capacitor cannot CBDT. What that means is change in voltage divided by the change in time multiplied by the capacitance. If you have no change, you will have no transfer. That means you must go from point A to point B. That means you have to have a delta change in voltage. Does that make sense?
Yes, that makes sense now. It has to be presented with the right current to do a job. I get it. I'm getting closer to it. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, let me just put my 2 cents worth in. It's not really where you put the capacitor that determines how capacitors work, because you can ground capacitors, you can put them in series. Capacitors block direct current, and they allow the transmission of alternating current. And if you want to think of it that this way, with direct current, the current, the electron flow into one of the plates and fills them up, and after a while, there's no more space for them, and so it repulses all the electrons who want to follow in the tradition, and so the instantaneous current exists, but over time, the instantaneous current goes to zero using only a capacitor. So capacitors in series will block DC current. If you put them in parallel to ground, they will bleed off the AC and just leave the DC on the line. So it's the capacitors work because that's what a capacitor is. It's completely different than an inductor. It has two dielectrics and it has two plates of metal and a dielectric in the middle of it. And so that's the inherent nature of capacitor. What you want the capacitor to do depends upon whether you're putting it in parallel, whether you're putting it in series. But it always does the same thing. It blocks DC currents and accepts alternating currents.
Okay, if it's presented with alternating current, is that when it stores it and disperses it?
Yes, it stores, releases, but for all intents and purposes, it's putting a current on that circuit.
Okay, I got it. All right. Well, thanks, everybody. I knew what they did. I just didn't know how they did it. So back to you, Roy. W2BZ.
And 2EPQ.
Yeah.
This is N2EPQ. You know, I just like to throw my 2 cents in here because I remember when I was actually in the beginning, when I was learning electronics, my father had a TV shop and that's how I was learning. But the most basic thing I remember about capacitors, it just struck in my mind, and this was as a very naive view, was that capacitors are basically two foils of metal. You know, like it's just two, like if you took two pieces of aluminum foil and insulated them in between the two, you'd make a capacitor. So if things are insulated, there's an insulation in between, the voltage from a battery is not going to get through there, but fields, you know, like alternating currents will. So just the fact that it's two separate pieces of metal, that stood out to me. I don't know if that helps any with this conversation. And to EPQ.
Okay, I mean, that's called the Leiden's jar. It was probably the first capacitor physicist toyed around with.
Yeah, you know, by the way, I just turned the radio on and I heard this conversation going, and you know, everything that you guys are saying, and it sounds right, but I thought to a person who is, you know, not into the more technical aspects of it, if you go down to the basics, boy, it really kind of makes sense, and that's nice what you just said, Roy.
Welcome. Leiden jars were very popular. Physicists or whatever they were called, the natural philosophers at that time, who were studying static electricity. Because, you know, you get these static generators, and then you can store the energy in a Leiden's jar for a little while. Like I said, all capacitors have an inherent leakage, and then you could use the static charge in the Leiden's jar to do little experiments and tricks with it. I still have a Wilmhurst generator sitting 2 feet away from me, because I love static electricity experiments and such, so... Yeah, you know, capacitors, like I said before, if you took the capacitors away from our electrical equipment, you'd have just paperweights. They are inherent in the design of just about everything. The only thing I can think of that could get away without a capacitor is a toaster.
That's a good point. That's a really good point. But what I really love about it is a lot of this stuff comes down to very simplistic terms that we all can understand if we think about it. But then when you want to really calculate exactly what's going to happen when you hook it all together, that's when all the mathematics and everything else kind of comes into play. But it's a very interesting topic. I never thought about that with a toaster. That's great.
Yeah, I'm sure someone's going to come up to me here and say that they have a smart toaster that has a CPU and a clock, and so it has RL circuit and crystals and all kinds of things. But I'm talking about the good old 1950s toaster that I grew up with. It's just a thermal element and a little heat switch that when it gets hot for a certain amount, it releases the connections. Completely, as far as I'm aware, I took a few of them apart. I never saw anything that even vaguely looked like a capacitor.
That's pretty good. Anyway, I'll let you guys get back to your conversation. I just wanted to jump in and put my little simple 2 cents in, into EPQ.
Isn't the whole toaster a capacitor?
Well, a capacitor for toast, maybe. Not really for electrons. Also, incandescent light bulbs don't use capacitors, so that's another device that can work without a capacitor. But most of modern-day electronics have capacitors all over them. Now they're surface mount. They look like little rice grains. Anyway, so, Rich, we done with the subject for tonight?
Yes, we are. Thanks, Roy, and thanks, everybody else. I really learned a hell of a lot. Thank you. Bye.
Ah, great. Glad to hear it. Frank, what's your question?
Yeah, very good. I actually have three, if I may. You decide how you want to deal with them. First of all, I'm kind of intrigued. I never really thought current, I suppose, does not travel at the speed of light. If the DC current is actually a flow of physical electrons, which have mass, which means, of course, they cannot travel at the speed of light, but is it feasible to measure how fast a DC current propagates through a wire? In other words, if you had a long enough string of, say, Christmas or Hanukkah lights, I guess, could you actually see them light as the current goes through it? I don't think I've ever heard of anybody observing that, but maybe I just never thought to look. Okay, and two other questions. First of all, you said you calculated the solved Schrodinger's equation for the hydrogen atom in a graduate course. Did you find Schrodinger's cat, and was the cat alive or dead? Go ahead.
No, afraid that they didn't allow cats into the class.
Oh, I thought the whole point of Schrodinger's equation was to find Schrodinger's cat.
No, that's a kind of a different thing in quantum mechanics of wave functions and collapsing wave functions. See, the problem, well, not the problem, but the point of Schrodinger's equation is that you cannot specifically say where an electron is because of the uncertainty principle. You could either describe the momentum of the electron or the position of the electron. You can't do both. So, and it moves. And what effectively does the Schrodinger's equation is a wave equation, which is a weird type of equation that usually is used for different waves. And the value squared gives you the probability of where you might find the electron. You know, some have a high probability, some have a zero probability. And so if you were to plot all the likely probabilities, locations within the probability equation, for lowest ground level of an electron, it's a sphere, which is a kind of very simple. If you raise it to the next level, it looks like a little bit like a figure eight or a barbell. And when you lift it to the next level, the orbitals, which are the probability of finding the electron, take on very weird shapes.
Okay, very interesting. Yeah, I was sort of kidding about the cat. I thought I remembered that that was actually a different, something different to what he dealt with. But what is the actual speed, if it's known, physical of a DC current then, if it's a flow of electrons and not an electromagnetic wave? Go ahead.
Okay. There's such things as drift velocity of electrons, if you want to know. And they're different depending upon the current and the voltage potential. So if you increase the voltage potential, you increase the electron flow, you effectively increase the rate of the electron drift. Electron drift, I believe, is the velocity of an actual electron from one end of the battery to the other end of the battery type of thing. Now, you can also kind of think of it as a pool of marbles. Just because you push one marble in one side doesn't mean the one that pops out the other side is the same marble. So you're not really measuring the phenomena of that one marble going through the pipe. You're looking at the phenomena of putting energy into one end, it comes out the other end a lot faster than the drift of the electrons going through the pipe themselves.
Then the energy actually does travel at the speed of light, even though the DC flow of electrons does not. Is that the idea?
It travels at the speed of light initially on the instantaneous current, because that's when you're changing voltage potential, so you're producing electromagnetic waves which propagate at the speed of light. But it settles down in steady state to somewhat slower, because ultimately when you're producing the same current flow without any alternating change, it doesn't produce electromagnetic waves. It produces an electrical charge, it produces magnetic fields, but not really electromagnetic. So initially, the initiating current is much faster than the effect from charged particles kind of popping out the other end.
WD2HWW.
Yes, Howie?
Well, we've done, you can do experiments. You can take a transmission line, put a scope at one end, and put a source at the other end, two pair of wires that are parallel, and you can see how long it takes to see the voltage at the other end, the waveform. It's a DC voltage. It's going to take some time. It's not going to happen instantaneously. I mean, it does take some time. It may not be the same electron, and also you have to look at the velocity factor of whatever you're using as a medium.
Okay, but now you're introducing things that have electromagnetic radiation with alternating or RF currents. It's just DC currents alone. It kind of simplifies it a little bit more.
VDH with a comment?
Yes, John.
Yeah, I do that experiment in my first lab in my transmission line course. It takes about about 70 feet of RG58U terminated with a 50-ohm resistor and put a pulse generator, a DC pulse generator, or just generating a step, and time the pulse through that length of cable, and it comes out to be pretty much the velocity factor. It's about for the 73 feet of cable I use, the propagation time is about 115 nanoseconds, which works out to be about 66% of c, the speed of light, which is the velocity factor for RG58U. Go ahead.
Well, yeah, I mean, that's the whole point of what the velocity factor means. It's the velocity of the current, of the RF current in your transmission line. But, again, I know the experiment would be kind of fouled up entirely, but what if you just ran direct current alone through the coax cable? There's no real way of measuring the velocity of it, but that's a kind of a different situation. We're just talking about direct currents. You know, how fast do direct currents propagate through a standard electrical circuit?
Well, it's a step of voltage. It's the rising edge of a voltage step. That's what I time.
Okay, but that's an instantaneous current to get. So the question just is, you have a steady state direct current. It's lighting up an incandescent light bulb, and if you could tag the electron at the beginning of the battery minus pole, what kind of movement will the current have? What kind of movement will the electron itself have?
If the light goes from off to on, it's a step. If the light stays on, and then you're just measuring the drift velocity, and there's really, unless you, as I say, hang a little tag on one electron, that drift velocity is very slow. But again, for the light to go from off to on is a rising step or transition.
Yeah, I realize that, and it's much easier to set up the experiment that way because then you could actually find something other than an imaginary tag on an electron. But the point when people kind of say a circuit, they usually, they're kind of just interested with a generic circuit that usually ends up being DC, like an incandescent light bulb or something. And so you'd have the drift velocity. You'd have the velocity of the charges as they kind of knock against each other and force the farthest one into the load and produce the heat that the incandescent light lights at. So you'd have a slower velocity for the electron traveling from one end to the other, a faster one for the current traveling within the electrons, free electrons, in the conducting wire of the circuit, and then if you had the instantaneous on and off, that would be even faster, approaching close to the speed of light. Any comments? Everyone seems to be silent.
B2BX.
I don't want to believe in such things. I got a big enough head. Jim, you wanted to say something?
Yeah. I wanted to applaud the copious use of mechanical analogies to get people from one step to the next. Excellently done tonight. An applause from my side. Back to that.
Very good. When John mentioned it, I thought to myself, Jim is going to enjoy this one.
I know they're not complete, but they're useful to get to the next step. I very much enjoy that way of learning.
Okay, but you have to kind of learn that there's a point where you got to step away from one analogy to a more complex difficult to wrap your head around analogy. Otherwise, you know, you're the guy who only owns a battle-flung radio.
Agreed. It's like a step on a ladder. You need the first step to get to the second step. But once you're on the step, you don't need the first step anymore. Yet it needs to be there when you pass by it.
Okay. I mean, I've used the hydraulics analogy for Ohm's Law. Matter of fact, it's so popular, I've seen it on people's T-shirts.
Guys pushing and pulling, I love that one. That's great.
Yeah, I agree.
VDH with a comment.
Yes, John.
I have an analogy for the transmission line. I don't know if it's too clear, but if you can imagine a long shaft, it can be a metal shaft, maybe. I don't know, 20 feet long, and it's mounted in bearings, supported every couple of feet. And you put a wrench on one end, and you give it a 90-degree twist. That twist propagates down the shaft, and after some delay, the far end of the shaft twists 90 degrees. Now, that is an analogy to a DC because we're not going back and forth. We're just making a step twist of 90 degrees, and that twist motion works its way down the line. This is where that old movie, I don't know if you've ever seen it, I think it's with Scheib or something, that wave machine that I saw years ago. It's on one of the YouTubes, I think, or the ATT Technical Channel. They have that machine, that wave machine. It's a very good demonstration for transmission lines. Okay?
Okay, very good. And it's a decent analogy to explain that high-speed alternating current is still work. If you take that shaft and instead of doing a 90-degree turn, keep on turning it 1 degree clockwise, then 1 degree counterclockwise, then 1 degree clockwise, then 1 degree counterclockwise, and you do that for about 10 minutes, you're going to be exhausted. Your shaft hasn't ultimately moved after all that time. But you're exhausted, so you could have work without any kind of final, obvious results. So, again, that kind of, I guess, is a good analogy for the idea of capacitors don't pass electrons, but they jiggle them around so much that they transfer the energy from one side of that capacitor to the other side of that capacitor, which is a form of current.
That's a good way to show the phase shift that occurs in a transmission line between the sending end and the receiving end when you put AC on it. For example, if the line is a quarter wave long and properly terminated, you have a 90-degree phase shift between the sine wave at the sending end and the sine wave at the receiving end. We're neglecting reflections because it's terminated, right? And that time delay for a sine wave manifests itself as a phase difference, which is what happens in a quarter wave line. Right?
Yeah, I mean, you could just go on and on. I mean, you could talk about how the innate rigidity of the material used for the shaft is similar, analogous to the velocity factor. A very stiff alloy is going to have a higher velocity factor than a very ductile one like, say, copper or lead.
Yes. As a matter of fact, it's the spring constant, the torque, the twisting spring constant, and the mass per unit length essentially determines the mechanical phase velocity on that line, just as the capacitance per unit length and the inductance per unit length on the transmission line determines its velocity factor.
Yeah, so it's a good analogy. I mean, ultimately, you're going to end up with a lumped circuit because you could do the most with that type of explanation. But, yeah, it makes for a very good analogy for a number of different things. We dropped back into silence. Frank?
Did you call me Roy WB2BXO?
Yeah, I thought you had a couple more questions there.
No, I was talking to Roy. No, I was the three questions. I was kidding you about Schrodinger's cat, and you answered the other one about the DC current. That, as a practical matter, it's the velocity factor. Those were pretty much my questions. And I sent you the article somebody sent me on long delayed echoes. That was about it. Go ahead, Roy. Did we lose our connection here, Roy?
Oh, I hear you, Frank. I don't know what happened to the other guy. You hear me? And how you doing? WD2HWW.
Yeah, he probably lost his connection. He'll come up on another connection, Howie. Yeah, good to see you on the net. Let me let the net control back in here. WB2BXO.
I hope I didn't put Roy to sleep. Okay, I'm going to get out of here. I got to take a four-legged friend down here. I got to see an eye dog that's wanting to go out for the last time. So let me get out of here. It's kind of interesting. Brings back a lot of stuff from college, a lot of stuff I've done over the years. WB2BXO, WB2HWW. Hope you're doing okay. It's been a while since I've spoken to you.
Sorry about that, guys.
Yeah,
that's for sure.
I know we used to cross paths at an occasional radio club dinner, date, and a couple of other, what the heck is going on? Oh, HRU and a couple of other things over the years. Anyway, 7-3, go take the doggy out. Before he leaks all over the place. WB2BXO.
Sorry about that, guys. Unfortunately, the application I use to go through All-Star, if you minimize it, you can't get it back. You can't kill it. You can't open a new one. So I had to go into Task Processor and kill it from that and then respawn it and turn it back on again. So I'm sorry for the delay. It's from, you know, trying to just click the taskbar and getting the minimize icon instead.
Sounds like what Zoom does on one of my computers. You know, Windows is weird, what can I say?
Yeah. Well, you know, you have to suffer through it. You have to pay for everything in this life. Computers are very good tools, but they can be very frustrating at times. So you try and figure out the best runaround that works, that doesn't take up too much time. The best I've found so far is using Task Manager to kill a process. I probably should set it up on my Stream Deck to kill the processor by just pushing a button, but this is the first moment I actually thought of that scam. So I'll have to think about it, and maybe for next week, just in case. This happens to be at least once every 6 months.
I guess that's what I should do when Zoom doesn't want to go away. But I think on the computer, I'm Windows 11 machine I'm using now most of the time, that doesn't seem to happen the way it did on my slower older machine. But it sounds like that would work. Go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, I've been perpetually having problems with, I think it's 24H2. It's the latest, greatest version of Windows 11. It works fine on my desktop, but if I try to install it in my other two computers, which are Lenovo's, it basically gives me the blue screen of death, and then it's smart enough to realize what happens, and it rolls it back to the previous version, the H23 version of Windows 11.
A buddy of mine, DKK6BXR, is convinced that Windows is designed to brick your computer every 2 or 3 years so that you have to go out and buy another one.
Thankfully, that has not been a big problem with me. This particular desktop is, I think, 6 years old. So, you know, it lasts longer than that. There are kernels out there that are more forgiving and kernels that are less forgiving. If you use Unix or even if you use Linux, you could have Linux running nonstop for a month without too many problems. Windows, usually every 2 to 3 days I reboot it, especially for things that I need it to work exactly the way I want it to work. Like 2 hours before this technical net, I always reboot my desktop just to make sure that it doesn't have any barnacles on it.
Yeah, that's weird. Yeah, I have a desktop that I ran for, I think, about 12 years until a couple of months ago. It finally just kind of stopped working, or essentially just started running much too slow to be useful. And I've been trying to convince a local teenager who works for the condo to try to reinstall Windows for me and get the computer running again, but so far he hasn't wanted to be bothered. You'd think he'd want the extra money. I guess when he does, he'll ask me, "Hey, do you want me to fix your computer?" Go ahead, Roy.
Yeah, it often surprises me. I tend to think that in the good old days, if you offered someone money for services, they were very likely to try, even if they didn't think they could do it. Nowadays, a lot of people don't seem to need the money, and I look at the findings and I wonder if they have a money tree in their backyard.
Yeah. Anyway, but maybe you're right. Anyway, I got some things to do here. I'm going to pop out for a little while, and I'll try to get back in here for Paul's report. Go ahead and see who else is around. WB2BXO.
Okay, very good, Frank. Thank you for participating. Yes, Jim.
If you're closing out, I just want to leave an ending comment on the capacitor thing. I've always found it amazing how the schematic diagram depictions of the resistor, the capacitor, and what are the other ones? The diode. How absolutely well it describes what the thing does in a little pictograph. And if you're trying to learn what these things do, look at that pictograph, and that's what it does. Just a thought. Back to that.
Yeah, but it depends on what country you're from. This is not the universal schematic diagram. If you look at any United Kingdom schematics, they draw resistors much more obliquely.
Well, there you go. I'll leave it at that.
Okie dokie. The United Kingdom symbol for a resistor is just a little rectangle. It doesn't have the seesaw back and forth of the extra piece of filament that, I guess, increases the resistance of the conduction. Anyway, I love schematics. One of the many things that I brushed up on when I was a kid with the ARRL handbook. Some schematic symbols are very esoteric. We pretty much all kind of know about capacitors, inductors, transformers, transistors, or at least bipolar transistors, but there are some very esoteric semiconductors that have symbols that are a little bit obscure themselves. So if you have nothing to do someday, just Google schematic components, and I'm sure you'll come up with a whole bunch of them that you think you've never seen before.
Yeah, in a past life I've seen quite a few, but those three stand out as being so descriptive of the device.
Yeah, I mean, what I find amusing sometimes is, you know, every so often someone will say, why are there so many different symbols for the ground? Because, you know, they see the little three lines at a 45-degree angle, then parallel lines that get smaller as you get farther away, and there's a couple other little symbols for ground. I think that's something that people start to question once they really look at schematics.
Ground's a tough one. What is ground? Oh, we could talk all night, right?
Yeah, I'd rather not, but yeah. Well, the problem has always been that physics too often reuses variables, they reuse words, and because they're vaguely similar, because they're sort of analogies, and we all get trapped into it because we don't really understand why they pick the name. You know, quantum mechanics has a quantum spin. Because it acts a lot like normal world angular momentum, but since electrons really don't physically spin, they have to spin faster than the speed of light, which is a violation. So because they're like angular momentum, they're called angular spin, but almost everyone forgets it, and they think that electrons are spinning like little tops.
Important in this discussion is the fact nobody really knows how it works. We're just grasping at it. And amazing the progress has been made, but what we don't know far exceeds what we do.
Perhaps, but we do know some things. You know, people didn't just come up with angular spin, quantum spin, because it sounded like a fun concept. It's actually used. Spintronics is a whole field of electronics, a little bit weird and a little bit esoteric, spintronics of just the quantum spin nature of electrons. Matter of 20-plus years ago, I was incessantly reading all the popular science articles. We're talking about how we were going to have much, much smaller memories. We do have smaller memories, but we're using pretty much the same technology we used 20 years ago. We tweaked it a little bit. But they were talking about being able to set electron spin on a substrate, and that would increase, 100 or 1,000-fold memory densities. So there is something to it. I know you're a disbeliever. You think that the scientists just sort of make stuff up as they go along, but They don't. It's based on findings, on experimental findings. They might have gotten some parts of it wrong, and they have to trace back and fix it. But it's not like this is a daydream among physicists.
I wouldn't say I'm a disbeliever. I just recognize the fact that we know as much as we know, and what remains to be discovered is vast.
Yeah, it probably will always be vast. It's the old canard that I've used the analogy of onions. The more you learn about a subject, the more you appreciate what little you know about the subject and appreciate how vast the subject ultimately is going to get for you. So, yeah. But we've made incredible advances over the last 100-plus years. All these marvels of modern science, modern technology can be used for good, it could be used for bad, but it's still there, and it all works. And it works because we have a glimmer of an idea of how all this stuff ultimately works, which is useful. When you do the pure science, you never quite know what you'll get out of it. I've mentioned before when Professor Hertz discovered radio waves, he was asked if there's any kind of economic benefit to be gained from it, and he said, no, it's just research. It's just an interesting thing I discovered. And little does he realize all the money that was made through the process of radio technology.
Pretty amazing thought. So I'll leave you with this question. I think it was Carl Sagan said the universe is not only stranger than we imagine, it's stranger than we can imagine.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that sentiment. You don't really know how much your brain can understand. The inevitable concept is that we might reach a point where our mind simply cannot deal with the underlying concepts that we're just coming ever so close to. And I think that's partially what's driving these lunatics about AI, that if we are just genetically not smart enough. Well, there's two groups. There's the guys who want to turn us into something else, so they want to turn us into super geniuses, or versus the guys who just want to build a super genius and run the power plants that feed the super genius and hopefully not be killed by the super genius.
You said that better than I ever could, so... Back to you.
Okie doke. Thank you very much, Jim. Once again, I continue to be AC2GS, and this continues to be the Flymark Technical Net. Anyone with any questions or comments or topics for discussion, hit that push to talk. Oh, well. Shame. Apparently, I would imagine that Brian isn't around tonight, because Brian usually lets us know when he's arrived on the technical net. Are you there, Brian? No, I didn't think so. Okay, guys, we'll give you one last opportunity. We theoretically go on with this for another 25 minutes, but if no one has a question or a comment or a topic or is in the mood, we can skip it for the SpaceNet report. So if anyone has any questions, topics, or what have you, hit that push to talk.
This is KG2RY. Just checking in.
Oh, okay, David. Consider yourself checked in.
Thank you very much. Yeah, I'm exploring a new acoustic instrument.
Okay. There's a lot of acoustic instruments out there. What particular acoustic instrument might this be?
It's a fretless classical guitar. So I guess I want to install a pickup on it. I have one of these piezo pickups that you attach directly onto the guitar. Then you connect a wire to the amplifier. You know, I'm wondering if this will be good enough.
Well, I don't know. I would assume, given the equal quality, I think the other version, the other pickup is a magnetic one, correct?
Well, you realize that the magnetic pickup is for steel strings. Magnetic pickup for steel strings. And then for anything else, a piezo pickup will work. Specifically, this guitar has nylon strings, so it has to, it has to generate sound through vibration.
Oh, okay, so the design of your guitar kind of limits your options to piezoelectric or optoelectric. So I guess it's really just a matter of getting a decent quality piezoelectric pickup. You know, there's probably different parameters of these pickups, that where one design might be slightly better for your particular guitar than another.
QSL, I have a steel string acoustic guitar. It has a Fishman rare earth pickup, which is magnetic. Two other guitars are classical, so they have piezo pickups. One is, it's attached on the bridge, and the other one is attached inside below the bridge. So they're like transducer pickups.
Okay. Is there any particular benefit of mounting it outside versus mounting it inside?
I don't think so, but I'm going to find out. I already own the pickup that I want to use. The guitar is on its way.
Very good. If you find anything interesting on differences between inserting it inside versus outside, I mean, ultimately it's stuck there on the wood, and the wood transfers the oscillations, the vibrations back and forth. So other than intensity, I wouldn't imagine there'd be a significant difference inside versus outside.
Probably not, but they do suggest that you find the sweet spot for the best possible sound. So they say the sweet spot usually, and maybe I'm wrong, that it's located a little bit above the bridge and then a little bit over toward the treble strings, you know. And I guess, you know, depending on the pickup that you have and how it's connected, you know, I bet it doesn't make really that much difference.
No. Well, I mean, theoretically, you could play around with it and have your own opinion of what's the sweet spot. I would imagine to a degree it's different for different types of guitars.
QSL. And they have these, transducer pickups. And they have four little pickups connected by wire to a jack, which is attached to the inside of a guitar. So you drill a hole at the bottom of the guitar, and you put the jack in, and then the transducers are attached below the bridge inside the guitar. I was considering that, you know, a passive pickup might be very good, and then I could run it through a preamp, you know, if I need to.
Yeah, that's certainly an option.
QSL, QSL. Yeah, I also have a travel size steel string guitar. It has a built-in pickup. It was installed by the manufacturer. And that pickup has a preamp built inside the guitar. And every maybe 6 to 8 years, I have to change the battery.
That is a good battery. What kind of a battery? I would guess silver oxide.
I don't know. It could be anything. 9-volt battery, just a regular 9-volt battery.
Oh, okay. I don't remember having a 9-volt. I assume you mean a transistor battery that lasted 8 years. That's a long time, even for a low load.
QSL. I don't know how many hours you get of use, but, you know, you have to plug it in, you know, in order for the circuit to turn on. So, yeah, and how many times I used it for how many hours, I don't know, you know. But it probably didn't take too much of a load off of that battery.
Yeah, I guess not. It's just that, you know, I'm kind of used to modern... batteries don't really have that quite that long a shelf life, you know, and that's one of the problems that you really have to source your batteries reasonably well, or especially in Amazon. They seem to get a lot of stock that's been sitting on a shelf for, you know, 5-6 years, and, you know, you go down to the reviews and you have people who say that they took this battery and they used it for 3 weeks and it died. So... no matter, you know, unless you have a ridiculous amount of poor usage, that's unusual. So I just, you know, it's been a long, long time since I heard anyone else say that they had a battery that lasted them 8 years. So I guess you were fortunate.
KG2RY. Well, inside the acoustic guitar, there's a also a battery in the pickup, and these are like, how to say, nickel-sized batteries, a little bit smaller. MS-76, I think, is the battery, and you put two of them in there, you know. Since I hardly use a guitar, you know, the batteries are still nice and fresh after maybe 7 or 8 years.
Yeah, okay, that's very good. That's a well-designed equipment. Unfortunately, I have a couple of A-Static B104s. They were originally designed for piezoelectric pickups, but I had a modification kit that you pop out that element and have a condenser element, and it has some circuitry to make adjustments for impedances, and... unfortunately, it requires a regular 9-volt transistor battery, and it's very poorly designed such that you could just kind of put in the 9-volt battery and put it on a shelf for about a month, and when you come back, the battery's dead. So it probably has some significant amount of current when you're not even using the mic. Theoretically, I guess you should really disconnect the 9-volt battery from its connectors until you want to use it. But I didn't know that the first time, and I discovered that limitation to its design.
Well, the guitars with the magnetic pickup, they have batteries, but, you know, the circuit is off. The circuit is off most of the time until you plug it into an amplifier or some kind of recording device.
Yeah, that's the preferable design, but I never really got to talk to the guys who came up with this circuit. It's really, they really kind of blew it on the battery. I mean, I guess if you use it every single day, it isn't that terrible, but I don't really care for using the A-Static 4. It's kind of heavy, and you got to move it around, and you got to keep your hand clasped to it when you're talking on it. I tend to like to use headsets. So they look nice, and as long as I use them for their looks, I don't have to worry too much that their impedance is not corrected with this circuit.
why not put a switch in there, turn the battery off when you're not using it?
Yeah, but that's partially going to kill some of the aesthetic. You know, all of a sudden, suddenly the chrome and some kind of surface damage around the edges, you have a switch sitting there. It looks very pretty. So I don't particularly want to use it, and since I want to see it, I probably